The information where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.
The legendary film director Stanley Kubrick sadly passed away back in 1999, and myself and Peter are great fans. Peter has been a long time admirer of Stanley Kubrick's work, and we want to discuss in this episode some of the mystery surrounding this cult figure, and whether or not he was aware of the New World Order and of the conspiracy topics that we cover in our podcast series in general, and how close he was to the NWO as well, because there's a lot of theories out there about what, you know, he was a Freemason, all this business, and it's a worthy point of discussion. So, Peter, you've been a as I say, a big admirer of Kubrick for many years now, and I think it's important to stress from the outset, if you aren't aware of cinema, he was a profoundly influential filmmaker. Mm-hmm. Many films that are seen today as classics, multiple genres. So you've got science fiction classics such as 2001, horror classics such as The Shining, and you've got the more obscure films and the more controversial films such as Eyes Wide Shut,
yeah,
which I'm sure we'll talk about. So what would you say? I mean, would you say that Kubrick was a man close to the NWO, a man that perhaps knew more than he let on? Or would you say that all this is just wild conjecture on the part of internet forums and the like, such as, you know, the IMDb database and all that, where people talk about this stuff at length?
So they say that on IMDb?
They do, yeah. Various forum threads on this stuff, yeah. Okay.
Well, let's take it back a bit, Martin. I think we're jumping the gun slightly. Let's explain. Stanley Kubrick was an American film director. He was born in 1928 in New York, and he made his early films in New York. He started as a documentary filmmaker. In fact, he started as a photographer with Life magazine. He did very good photo sprints for Life magazine. He didn't get on well at school, and he quit before he took his exams, but he managed to get a job with Look magazine, not Life magazine, taking photographs. Then he made a couple of films. One was called Day of the Fight, which is about boxers, about 10 minutes long, and the other one was Flying Padre, about a flying vicar, with a flying license who goes to his ministry, which is spread out over the American prairies. He also made a very little known film, just a pay for hire job film about Seafarers Union, which is bizarrely his first film in colour, but that's a kind of lost, unknown film, hardly ever seen. But generally he made his own films. He made a film that is hardly ever seen, I've never really seen, called, let me see, they've got funny titles, they usually have Fear and Killing and things like that in the title. There's one called Fear and Desire. Then there's Killer's Kiss.
Yeah.
That's the one we've seen. The Fear and Desire is one Kubrick withdrew himself from circulation. It was based on a kind of Second World War ideas. But it's a bit of a supernatural film as well. It's sort of a dreamlike film. But there's only one print in existence, and it's in a private collection. And it's never been released since the 50s. The Killing, Killer's Kiss. Then it was, Spartacus, Lolita,
Paths of Glory,
Doctor Strangelove, or How We Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, 2001 Space Odyssey, of course, A Clockwork Orange, Barry Lyndon, The Shining,
Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah, all we're coming in now. He was born around then, he can remember this. And Eyes Wide Shut, yeah, his last film. And then, of course, AI, Artificial Intelligence, which we mustn't forget. So it's also two films that were never completed. One was called Napoleon, and the other was called The Aryan Papers. So we go back to the 50s, he's spanning from the 1950s right through to 2001, of course, including AI, Artificial Intelligence. And that was actually directed by Steven Spielberg, who became a friend to Kubrick's in late life. And for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to count AI in the canon of Kubrick work, because I think we obviously want to refer to everything he did.
Sure. Really.
His early films were black and white, not surprisingly. They followed a noirish tradition. They're based often on novels. The Killing was a very good time-twisting crime story based on the novel Clean Break by Lionel White, which is about a racetrack robbery, but the film is told from many different angles and mixes time up in the telling. The film that preceded that, Killer's Kiss, is a more conventional noirish crime story. Made with a lot of pace. I've got a copy at home. There's an excellent chase scene at the end, a fight with mannequins that gets stabbed with various sharp implements, and you feel it represents human bodies getting stabbed. It's kind of noirish, Hitchcocky type of stuff. But at that stage, not anything you'd say is beyond good filmmaking in a clear Hollywood noirish hard-boiled tradition of filmmaking. And they made this film, The Killing. Now, which one came after that? It gets a bit confusing. Now, we had Paths of Glory came next, I think. And that was the First World War story. And that was banned in France for many, many years. In fact, right through to the 1970s, I believe. Because it shows the French army in a very poor light to actually shoot, those who don't want to go over the top, basically, on a useless assault on a thing called the Ant Hill, which is a mound in no man's land. And it's very much like Oh, What a Lovely War in that depiction of the First World War. And there's a very unsentimental ending where the soldiers are shot, and then at the end of the film the German girl sings, and they're allowed just to listen to this a little bit further before they go on into the front again.
Yeah, it's a very moving scene, that.
And she's actually became Kubrick's third wife, in fact, the actress who played that part, who wasn't really an actress particularly, and she's mainly an artist. She's still alive now, living up in Hertfordshire. But then, Kirk Douglas, I believe, because he was in Paths of Glory, he asked Kubrick to step in when Anthony Mann couldn't complete the film Spartacus, which Anthony Mann had just started directing. Spartacus is a big widescreen film, Technicolor, or certainly colour. I mean, what year would that be now? That'd be late 50s, possibly, so it wouldn't be Technicolor, but it'd be a colour process or whatever the trademark they called it, but widescreen, a lot of location stuff, some studio type settings as well. And it tells the story of Spartacus, obviously the very famous scene where everyone stands up and goes, "I'm Spartacus," all this sort of stuff. So we're touching there on ancient Rome, and obviously if you look at conspiracy stuff in history, a lot of things go back into that period. You know, Hollywood used to be called, the New Babylon, or there's a book, I think, called Hollywood Babylon. And Hollywood was very interested in, these great epic films like Cleopatra and stuff like that. And they build, whole huge sets almost as big as the real pyramid. If you look at Las Vegas today, it's got a pyramid that's bigger than the real pyramid. As some say, it's like a kind of all-seeing eye type pyramid. And so Hollywood, by no mistake, made these big film set in Europe and the Middle East, but shot in California, which had desert to make them in. And many say that they're about Illuminati themes. If you look at the idea of, conspiracies coming from ancient Greece, ancient Rome. But Spartacus is one of that type of film. It fits into that sort of genre very much.
Sure.
So you can say that Kubrick had the background of being a Hollywood mainstream filmmaker in that sense. And he'd already done the noirish stuff before that. But on Spartacus, he felt very restricted by Hollywood. It was kind of telling him how to do certain bits of the film, making it more sentimental than he wanted, because he tended to have a very hard view of life, which had formed early on, it seems. I mean, that's something we may want to discuss. Why did he have that view? Maybe it came from him working for Look magazine, being a photojournalist. He was the son of a doctor in New York who was Jewish. I know there's always a talk of Jews being involved with conspiracies. I don't want to go down that route particularly, but it may be that he had some sort of link with somebody who knew about stuff going on. I don't know, but it's not an angle I really want to stress here. He said he came from an intelligent family in New York who were connected a little bit, but no more than anybody else. So he certainly had a very intelligent view of things. I don't personally see evidence for New World Order connections there, but he certainly had a wry view of life early on.
I think there's a view that he was in contact with Lyndon LaRouche on a regular basis, who I'm not too aware of the character of the guy Lindsay LaRouche, but I mean my knowledge of is that he is quite a notorious editor, publisher of various alternative magazines.
Yeah, he publishes a thing called Executive Intelligence Review.
Right.
I know that. But that's a bit later on in the chronology.
Right.
So we'll hold that one for a minute.
Yeah.
I mean, after Spartacus, he made a film called Lolita. It's based on a novel called Lolita, not surprisingly. A very controversial book about underage romance. It's put it like that. It's not particularly, by today's standards, I have to say. I have read it. It's a very entertaining book by Vladimir Nabokov. You know, it's a work of literature, but then there's as someone I kind of mocked to say, you know, is that what you would order want, books about underage romance and stuff like that. I use the word romance here, covering up. Don't really want to go down certain angles here, but I wouldn't say it's a particularly explicit book, put it that way, not by today's standards, but obviously it's touching on areas that are very taboo, to say the least, implying them anyway. And the film, you know, isn't that... you know, explicit. It's made as a bit of a comedy, and again noirish, but it's touching on controversial areas. And Kubrick actually came to England to make that film, even though it's set in America, which seems a strange thing to do, because he felt there was less censorship over here. That's the story we're told anyway, that he felt there was less censorship. He had a lot of problems in America from the League of Decency, the religious side in America, saying, you know, you can't make this film. It's immoral. And so he came to England to make it. Now, what that says about Britain, I don't know, but the whole film's set in America, in the Midwest, so it's a bit of a problem making it in Britain, you might think. A lot of it's in studios, interiors. There are scenes driving across the desert where you get good old rear projection effects used. So it's fairly convincing. I mean, there's a few scenes where the houses maybe look a little bit more like you might find them in Hemelhampstead than... the Midwest of America, but right. you can swallow that. There's many, many weirder examples of that in films. I'd say it's very convincingly done for a black and white film, and again, it's entertaining on the surface of it, but it does have a bit of the old Europe creeping in. He puts in a few gothic touches that you wouldn't find in a novel with Peter Sellers coming in doing his various parts, but there's a great gothic manor house in the film where we go to at the start and at the end, which... offhand, I don't think it's in the book, but this is seen as a touch of you know, Kubrick's European background, because obviously yeah. They come from Europe originally, moving to New York. I don't know when his dad moved to New York. I don't know how long they lived there, but like a lot of Americans, they're basically immigrants in their own country, even if it goes back a few generations. So there's always a bit of old European lore coming into films. And that's why a lot of Disney films, for example, had European stories in them, like Pinocchio and these sort of stories, because they were brought from Europe and recreated in America, so they give them an American spin, but they were all based in Europe, really. So Kubrick, like making Lolita in Britain, was coming back to Europe and making an American story, but putting in a bit of this European gothic stuff, which again, you know, some say relates to kind of Illuminati themes of you know, old dark houses and ancestral manors and that type of thing. I mean, then move on to his next film, Doctor Strangelove, which again is set in America and in an airplane which is flying around Russia, so it's not in America, it's not in England, it's just an abstract setting. And, you know, both at an air base, Bobos, an Air Force base in America and the Pentagon. So three settings, basically, the plane, the Pentagon and the Air Force base. Two of which a studio created, and the Air Force Base is partly using, I think, the exterior of a studio to represent an Air Force Base. So it's all either done in a studio or using Britain again to stand in foreign locations. Again, you must have felt you had more control doing it in Britain, and it's based on a book by Red Alert by Peter George, which is a serious look at what would happen if a low echelon American general set off a nuclear war, thinking a president had already been killed. And it's a kind of a little clause that they can do, at least in the story. I don't know if it exists in real life. But in the film, it's made into a comedy, to some degree a black comedy, and there's a conspiratorial overtone that, in a sense, is about population reduction, that there could be a war getting rid of the population, and then you have the various sort of chosen ones who are based under the Pentagon, living under a underground, really, for a period of time with life support systems, and emerging into a kind of new world afterwards. So this is discussed in the film by the characters, but it isn't shown as such. It's generally a kind of nuclear type of story.
Yeah.
The next one, 2001, we're whizzing through these just to give you the background, is based on a short story called The Sentinel by Arthur C. Clarke. Kubrick wanted to make a definitive good science fiction film for a long time and had been looking around for subjects. And he found, he bought a few stories by Arthur Clarke, and he liked this one in particular. And they expanded it into the story known as 2001, A Space Odyssey. There's been debate about who did more of that. I believe the title was Kubrick's own. And Odyssey comes from the Greek Odyssey, of course, that goes back to ancient times again, which is quite nice because he made Spartacus, who's bringing an Odyssey into space in this film. And setting it in 2001, again, if you watch the film, there's a lot of technological advances, far more than we've actually had by 2001 in real life.
Yeah,
they have
far more.
Moon landings happening in, well, probably before 2001, and then they've got a Jupiter mission. It's not said in the film. In fact, you never hear the name of the year in the film anywhere. So it could be set further ahead of time or a few years each side of 2001. But it's certainly set, you know, in a more advanced society than you'd have thought they... I think even then they wouldn't have thought they'd get all that by 2001. So there's been thought that Kubrick may have known that 2001 was a key year of some sort. And I'll come back to that in a minute. There's something I read on the internet about this. It's a bit kooky, and I don't want to get drawn into it just yet. But suffice it to say, 2001 is a film about, you know, an ape turning into a man who invents technology, goes into space and finds a higher level of intelligence, which is extraterrestrial in Arthur C. Clarke's version. And in Stanley Kubrick's version, is possibly that, or possibly something a bit more philosophical, because he does show it in a very abstract way. It's not, you don't see any kind of bug-eyed monsters come out and shake the guy's hand at the end, you know. It's
just a monolith.
Yeah, a monolith, and it's very abstract colour effects, and a strange hotel room that appears, which looks like 18th century. So again, it's being created by the man's mind. So it's not necessarily, you know, a real thing that's happening. It could be a kind of psychological thing. Or it could be a chamber that's been created by aliens for him to feel at home in, which is what Arthur C. Clarke says. If you read the novel, it's more sort of literal. And if you read the sequel that Arthur C. Clarke wrote, it's much more literal. It kind of gives it all away. And Stanley Kubrick didn't like the film 2010 that was directed by Peter Hyams in 1984, which was a sequel to 2001, but kind of explained everything in a really literal way, that it was aliens and this sort of thing. He felt it was very literal and it hadn't really been what he'd meant, or it was just giving things away, and he didn't want to give things away, you know.
Sure.
His next one was A Clockwork Orange, based on a novel by Anthony Burgess. It's a, you know, a quite cheaply made film compared to 2001. Very notorious. It was never banned. It's been a complete load of rubbish said about this. It was withdrawn by Kubrick because he had some death threats to his family. And if it wasn't withdrawn, there'd be trouble. So he withdrew it from circulation in Britain. But it was never banned in Britain. It never has been. He owned the rights to the film and he was entitled to withdraw it. And it was re-released again when he died, after he died.
Yeah.
And it's a film about a guy called Alex Delarge, who's part of a gang known as the Droogs. And they're kind of like a violent gang set in a slightly nihilist, but nevertheless slightly psychedelic pop art version of England in the near future, which could be the 80s or the 90s, or even possibly now, but they've got little cassettes, they don't have MP3s when they listen to music, so maybe it's a kind of a strange version of the late 90s. So 20 or 30 years ahead anyway, when it was made. And it's about law and order, a big subject with the London riots, of course. And Alex's gang go around, you know, doing various crimes very randomly and without motive, and then the gang turn on Alex, they knock him out, he spends time in prison, he wants to become a reformed character, but he wants to be released after having done a murder, so they turn him into a Clockwork Orange, which is using a kind of mind control technique, where he has an aversion to violence, which is created by showing him violent films and drugging him, and he doesn't, he reacts every time he sees violence after that, he feels physically ill. But this is then seen by the kind of right-wing totalitarian government in the film as being a form of mind control, that they shouldn't do that and he should have free will. And at the end of the film, Alex is given back his free will and chooses possibly violence again. And that's the end of the film. In the book, there's another chapter where he does decide to reform himself, although that chapter was omitted from, I think, the American edition, but it was put in the English edition. So you can miss that out or not, but Kubrick chose to miss it out, so he chose to give it the more controversial ending, that Alex could have free will even if he was violent. The next film is based on a book by William Makepeace Thackeray called The Luck of Barry Lyndon. The film's called Barry Lyndon. Kubrick had hoped to make the Aryan Papers, set in the Second World War, about Jewish refugees, I think, in the Second World War. He put a lot of work into it, and it was going to be the kind of Schindler's List of its day, but it didn't happen for some reason or other. Then he wanted to make a film called Napoleon, about Napoleon, fairly obviously. Again, another epic, it didn't happen. So he went to this Barry Lyndon book, which is a... Again, I have read the original. It's very difficult reading by today's standard. It's rather stilted language. But all the characters are in there that he used. He omitted a lot of slapstick elements and very long-winded episodes in the book. And, cut to the story, which is the rise and fall of an Irishman in aristocratic society. He tries to marry into aristocratic society. You could say the Illuminati. Again, going back to the great houses, as seen in Lolita, where you go to these great houses to have a higher form of existence. He marries in, but then he's found out essentially as being a crude, vulgar Irishman who's not of the proper bloodline, and he's rejected from the situation at the end of the day, ends up in poverty. So it's a kind of rise and fall story, but you can say there are scenes in there which do allude to the Illuminati, certainly. Our next one is The Shining, which is a very, very good film about supernatural. It's about a writer who moves to a hotel for the winter in order to complete a novel, and he moves in with his wife and son because the hotel snowed in over the winter, and they need a live-in caretaker. Unfortunately, the hotel's built on a burial ground, a Red Indian burial ground, and the writer's having a nervous breakdown. He's an alcoholic, and we're not sure if he's hallucinating or whether they're real spirits that enter the hotel, but they manifest themselves in several ways, very abstract ways, like strange events, objects moving around by themselves, this sort of thing. But also he does seem to go back in time and enter the lobby as it was in the 1920s or 30s, and it's almost like he's seeing ghosts from the past. So they're not Red Indian ghosts, they're ghosts of the hotel's previous life. And it seems that he was a caretaker there before. So at the end of the story, the guy, the caretaker, tries to murder his family, but he doesn't succeed. And he's left in the hotel at the end. I won't give the ending away, but you may well have seen the film. And it's a very chilling story, but it kind of outlines, do supernatural things exist, and do they control us, or is it more that we have our own problems that which make us feel that we're out of control, when we have alcohol and stuff. But in this story, in the end, it is the supernatural that kind of is real in the story. The next film, Full Metal Jacket, is a military story about the Vietnam War, which was taking place, of course, while Kubrick was filming 2001, Space Odyssey. It's based on a book by Gustav Hasford called The Short Timers. And Gustav Hasford was a Vietnam veteran, wrote the book. The book's a bit longer than the film. It has several other incidents that happen after the sniper attack in the film. But the film chooses just to use the first two-thirds of the book. And again, Kubrick upped the sort of, I won't say comedy, but he brought in... a guy called Michael Ho had written the narration for Apocalypse Now, and Michael Ho added more beefy kind of dialogue to the film, and a real training instructor called Lee Ermey came in and actually did the part for real as a drill instructor, bringing a very violent verbal assault to the soldiers as they're trained to go into Vietnam. One of them cracks up, shoots the drill instructor, then they go to Vietnam where they kind of learn that they've been turned into machines, and they're now able to kill because they've been controlled by their training. In a sense, it's almost like another Clockwork Orange in a way. It's the same kind of idea of having your mind controlled by a society that's been set up to control you. And, you know, it's at the end of the day, they all sing the Mickey Mouse song, which is interesting because, again, I was talking about European fables being brought into Hollywood. And Mickey Mouse, you know, it's almost a kind of... there have been things said about Disney and whether the various symbols in his films are mind control symbols and parts of Project Monarch and this sort of thing. It's a whole subject I'd be too big to go into here, but Mickey Mouse could be a sort of reference to mind control, being controlled by the system, by Hollywood, by, you know, various triggers that are put into those who have been mind controlled. There was a very long break after Full Metal Jacket, where Sidney Kubrick would never make another film. By then he was in his late 60s, and many of us thought, you know, we'd never see another Kubrick film. There was talk of AI, artificial intelligence, and rumours he was making this science fiction film on and off in London, but no footage was ever released. He may have been doing some footage. He did shoot some footage himself, allegedly using various techniques, but it wasn't quite what he wanted. And he was also planning a book based on a novel called Trom Nouvelle by, I can't remember the guy's name who wrote it now, but it's a 19th century or early 20th century book about a dream world. It's called a dream novel, and it's about a couple go off to a party and they have various motives for jealousy, and one goes off into the night, has various adventures. I haven't read this book, so I can't say how near to the film it is, but I believe it's very close to the film because the screenplay is written by Frederick Raphael, who was brought in by Kubrick. And he said, I want this transposed directly into a film. And Frederick Raphael said, oh, you know, this is very sort of strange material to set in the 20th century. But Kubrick insisted. So Frederick Raphael transposed it directly into a kind of New York setting, even though it was still filmed in Britain, bizarrely. And he built whole streets of New York in a studio to film it. And there are some shots in the film taken in New York, but they're just like establishing shots. And yeah, it's a very effective film where we have a kind of almost Dennis Wheatley kind of ritual in the middle, where Tom Cruise, playing the character, goes off from his wife, who he's basically a bit fed up with, and has this adventure being sucked into a strange cult. So it seems to be a kind of wife-swapping, slightly occultist, satanic. It's implied that it's satanic. You don't see any kind of goat's heads and stuff, but you see some pretty strange masks and incredibly strange music by Jocelyn Pook. And that was a very eerie atmosphere created in the film. And then he seems to learn secrets, so then he's going to give some of these away, or he has broken the code of secrecy, and he's told in no uncertain terms that you better not talk about this, keep your eyes wide shut. Apparently eyes wide shut is, or something very like it, is a Freemasonic term, and it could be that Kubrick took the title, which isn't the title of the novel, from some knowledge of Freemasonry. And you're meant to keep your eyes wide shut if you know about stuff like this. And again, sadly, Kubrick passed away in March 1999 in his sleep in Hertfordshire, after the very near to final cut of the film had been given to Warner Brothers. It still needed a bit of colour timing, a little bit of other work on it. But they accepted its final cut, may not have been the final release version if Kubrick had carried on. It was slightly cut down for American release. They took out some of the ritual scenes and put in some CGI objects and blocked certain parts of the frame. Again, in Britain, they released the version as made, which had a bit more nudity and stuff in it, which America didn't want to have on the screen. And it, as far as we know, it's what Kubrick would have released, but it probably would have had a few more trims here and there to it. But it was put together, you know, very much as he would have wanted it to be. It was 99% finished when he died. Then Spielberg, who's a friend of Kubrick's from the days of Full Metal Jacket, obviously known about Kubrick's death, wanted to take the work that Kubrick had done on AI, artificial intelligence, which carries forward Kubrick's ideas from 2001, where we have HAL 9000, the superintelligent computer, and puts it into actually robotic form. He brought in a novelist called Brian Aldiss, who described this as being called in like the plumber. Kubrick calls in the writer like a plumber to fix parts of the story, then kind of dismisses them when he's had enough. But Brian Aldiss had a story called Super Toys Last All Summer Long about a robot boy and Kubrick extended this, again using the European fable of Pinocchio, which Disney of course had used before. So it's got a slightly esoteric edge, but he's putting it into a science fiction context about the boy who wants to be a real boy, but of course he can't be, he's only a super intelligent robot. Eventually he befriends Jude Law, playing another robot, an adult version, and they go off on a series of adventures. Eventually the boy robot is entombed in New York, quite near the World Trade Center, strangely enough, which survives for 2,000 years, frozen, gradually toppling down, because in the far, far future, they're found by extraterrestrials who've landed then on a lifeless planet, and their intelligence means they can find this robot boy who's the only creature still living on the planet, and they sort of grant his wish by allowing him to meet his mother again, but they recreate her by sort of DNA decoding from I think a strand of hair or something that's in the boy's pocket. So they use their own technology to give him the illusion of being alive and fully alive. So he kind of gets his wish brought in by not fairies or fairy godmother, but by extraterrestrial intelligence intervening. And here we do see actual aliens very much on the screen, unlike in 2001 Space Odyssey. So that's a broad overview going quickly through all of Kubrick's films. And I don't think we missed out any there. We've done them all. But it only made about 10, 13 films in his life, and one we've never seen, Fear and Desire. And apart from the film about the Seafarers Union, which I think was just a bit of work he did for money as a one-off when he was younger, I think they've all been films under his control.
Mm. Well, yeah, no, that's a great sum up there, Peter. And I mean, the thing that you realise with Kubrick is his films covered so many different themes, and each one seemed to touch on some profound aspect in ways that no other films really come close to. And I'm thinking chiefly here of 2001, elements of Barry Lyndon, but I think sometimes it's hard to sort of see beyond the source material of Barry Lyndon, but also obviously the key one, a film like Clockwork Orange and Eyes Wide Shut. So obviously there's speculation on the internet and age-old theories about Kubrick and his association, his links with the Freemasonic circles of probably England, I guess, considering he spent most of his life in England, sort of Scottish Rite Freemasonry. From your knowledge of Kubrick, I mean, what's your personal take on this idea that he was basically an inside man making films that were touching on sort of elements and themes that he was sort of making suggestions with each film of deeper truths or hidden agendas, if you like?
Yeah, I always felt I was drawn to his films, and I came to them by seeing 2001, as many will be drawn to, because it's the most accessible film, really. It's in a way the most abstract, but it's also the least verbal. So if you like spaceships and stuff, you're going to go and watch it anyway, and it can draw you in, and that's great, particularly in the Time and Space Race when I first saw it. And I saw it in the classic down in Brighton, now Waitrose. Always good to see them on the big screen. But I got a book about the making of 2001. That was fascinating and taught me some of the stuff I've said about the film.
Yeah.
And all the techniques, how it was made. But it did touch, and he mentioned some of his other films like Doctor Strangelove. So I went and got a book by Alexander Walker called Stanley Kubrick Directs. And Alexander Walker was a great friend of Stanley Kubrick, who's a great film critic, and he's now passed on as well, sadly. But he wrote probably one of the very best books on Kubrick. And he does, you know, say how many directors make good films, but very few possess a conceptual talent, which is the way to make a film that isn't just a telling of the story, but where the actual creation of the film seems to encapsulate it in a way that seems, when you've seen the film, to be the only way it ever could have been done. It becomes a concept, not just a film. And that most engendered the films of Stanley Kubrick.
Right.
And that's what Alexander Walker says. And if you watch any of Kubrick's films, they're all made in that way. There's an intelligence there, and they're put together like Swiss watches. And you go, that totally says what he's trying to say.
Absolutely.
And you might debate what he's trying to say, but you know he's saying what he wants you to hear. Now, the Freemason thing, I haven't seen any evidence. I'm not saying it's not true. But there's a lot of stuff on the internet about Kubrick that I'm very wary of, because a lot of people talk absolute crap about this. And the trouble is there may be things on there that are true, but we've got to really have a very big sieve here with this stuff. Because unless they know about the actual official story, starting with the moon landings and stuff like that, you've got to know the official story to then say what isn't true. I mean, if they say things like Kubrick directed the moon landings, well, he might actually be busy directing 2001 on those particular days, you know. Okay, it came out just before, but, you know, he couldn't have been doing all that at the same time. You know, there's chronologies you can follow where you know where someone was on a certain day, what they would have done. And there'd be no reason for him to direct the moon landings. There's probably a bit of shared technology. He did get a lot of people from NASA helping him. And I do believe the technique of front axial projection, which is projecting very high resolution transparencies, or basically photographs, onto a very reflective background to create very realistic settings where you can place objects into a photographic background. That technique was used in 2001 at the start of the film mainly, where you see the apes in Africa, but it's all shot in a studio, but the actual backgrounds are taken in Africa by a second unit. And it's also used in the film in some other scenes as well. That technique is definitely, in my view, the technique that's been used to produce some of the NASA photographs that we've seen, where there are
the Apollo missions.
Yeah, where there are landers in the foreground and a background that doesn't quite tie up with the foreground. There's a bit of a gap, and there's clearly a background that's slightly softer in its effect of definition, you know?
Sure.
That I'd say is definitive that that was done. I don't think he would personally need to have gone and done that. And I don't think he needed to direct Neil Armstrong or someone walking down the ladder, because there's not much acting involved there anyway. You know, he wouldn't need to direct that. I think if he had, it would have been a bit better, to be honest.
Right.
So I think he may have given them some advice, you know. They may have asked him about this or just come over and visited the set, seen what he was doing, and then thought, hold on, we like that idea.
But I think there's a theory that I've read where people speculate that Kubrick knew that the moon landings had been faked.
He could have done, yeah. But who do you tell?
Yeah.
Maybe. You know, I'm not saying he didn't know these things, but I'm not saying he was, I mean, we might know it, but we didn't do it. You know?
Yeah.
Doesn't mean to say he did it. But he was working with NASA to get details for the film. So there would be a crossover, undoubtedly. I just don't think he necessarily knowingly did it himself. I think he might have known they were up to something, but he might have had reasons why he didn't want to say, if he even knew that. I think he might later on have looked at the photographs and gone, yeah, that could well be the old front projection.
Sure.
There, you know.
Yeah.
And Douglas Trumbull would probably be the person to ask this. He'd probably know more about that side of things, to be honest.
Right.
Because
the director of Silent Running.
Yeah, that's right. And he worked on effects in 2001.
Right.
Yeah.
So the main theory about Kubrick, it all really does go back to his last, well, if unless you include AI, his last cinematic release, Eyes Wide Shut. This is where most of the debate seems to exist.
Yeah.
So this is it's a very profound film. It's actually one of those films that got quite slammed by the critics at the time, but I think it's certainly regarded now as a classic and a masterpiece in many respects. And,
yeah.
And a lot of critics who at the time pretty much slammed the film have actually since come back and said, actually, no, this is a very good film. And it's one of those films that just didn't... It's like any kind of classic film. It seemed to be quite ahead of its time.
Yeah.
And people perhaps weren't quite ready to see what they were seeing on screen in the cinema, because obviously visually there's a lot going on with this film, a lot of controversial stuff,
yeah,
of a sexual nature really, yeah, mostly, but also of a slightly more kind of symbolic nature. And the stuff that you read, I mean, the general consensus is just the bog standard one, which is that, well, Kubrick was basically portraying what goes on behind the scenes in these sort of Freemasonic circles, in these sort of satanic rituals, Bohemia Grove. It all goes back to this kind of idea that you've got the elite of the world, rich businessmen, rich politicians, attending these events where essentially they're able to get up to this stuff that's portrayed in the film, sort of sexual orgies, stuff that's seen, perceives, if you like, as the kind of thing that they shouldn't be involved with, certainly not in a public setting, like a sort of manor house or whatever.
Yeah.
Or, you know, obviously it's, but it is behind closed doors, but it's done in a strangely kind of open way, where you get sort of groups of people, 30 or 40 in a room overlooking it, like these big orgies, and obviously there's indications that if you get too close to this, you're killed, and yeah. People are bumped off in mysterious ways, and it's a popular theory that Kubrick died as a result of that film. So in other words, he was killed as a result of making his film. I mean, what's your take on that?
Well, the timing would indicate that he just delivered it to Warner Brothers. They screened the film. Kubrick had the contractual right not to release the film if he didn't want to, like Woody Allen has. He can make a whole film, then he can just say, oh, nah, don't really like that, put it away. Is that powerful, you know, because
yeah.
he's like a real star
yeah.
to have on your roster. But he was going to release it. He didn't go, oh, no, I don't like this one. He said, this is my best film. Delivered it. And they kind of saw it and probably jaws dropped a bit, you know.
Yeah.
But they said, I think they were pleased with the cut. They said, yeah, we've got it. We're satisfied with it. And I remember this from the time in March 99 when this happened. And then, yeah, a few days later, he was dead, you know, I think of a heart attack in bed in Hertfordshire, you know. It could be a coincidence. You know, let's never say it couldn't be. I mean, Dennis Potter was dying when he wrote some of his last plays, and he just kept himself going on, you know, whatever medication while he wrote Cold Lazarus and another screenplay. And then he passed away shortly afterward before they were even shot, you know. There have been precedents for that. But Kubrick was only 70. He wasn't that old. I mean, Ridley Scott's still hammering away at 72, making new films. He was a bit overweight, perhaps, you know, I don't know. But I wouldn't say there was anything that made him suddenly die. These things can happen. Of course they can. But it's a strange coincidence, certainly, you know.
Yeah.
It's a strange yeah. one. You know, if it was done, maybe with some sort of drug or a weapon firing in some way, or even a satanic, you know, kind of spell, even, I don't know. I
mean, microwave weapon sort of Tim
possibly,
Reef style
yeah,
stuff.
That sort of thing. It's conjecture, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't like, with Kubrick, I take it very seriously, Kubrick stuff.
Yeah.
And while I'm sometimes willing to kind of go off on UFOs and spin off a yarn, with Kubrick, I really do have to be quite solid in what I'm saying. I mean, I did refer to some internet stuff a little way back. It was a bit way out. One I read the other day was about 2001, and it said, you know, that Kubrick knew the year 2001 was going to be significant, and that's why he called his film 2001.
Right.
Well, that might be true, you know, because there's no indicator in the film that it's set in that year.
He had visions, apparently, didn't he? Of
well, this is what, yeah, this is yeah. what I read, yeah, yeah.
According to what's out there, yeah.
He had visions of something bad happening, and every time he thought about it, he would see a building falling down.
Right.
So he made the building into a monolith, which the monolith isn't in the original story. It's a big crystal, I think, or a pyramid in the original story. So he put in a monolith, and 2001, so the idea is there. There's an idea that it's in Full Metal Jacket. The monolith appears in Full Metal Jacket.
I've not heard that one.
And it was heard at the time. It was in a French magazine, which I bought in the 80s when he was interviewed, gave a rare interview in this French magazine, which I haven't read. It's all in French. You have to sort of read it quite slowly to get the drift of it. But apparently when the cowboy's dying, behind him there's something that looks like the monolith. It's actually a bit of the building, you know, but it looks like the monolith standing behind him.
Right.
It's quite a nice little touch.
Yeah.
And of course the World Trade Center does appear in AI, although it's crumbling a bit. But that was released in 2001, but it's in the film.
Yeah.
Came out just after 9/11. And it is glimpsed in Eyes Wide Shut in one or two shots, I believe. I can't remember, I haven't seen it for ages, but I think you see the bottom of the World Trade Center in one or two shots
right.
of downtown New York. I mean, maybe not surprisingly, perhaps, you know, if you're filming around there, but it's still included in the film. So, you know, that's an interesting point. Whether these things are Freemasonic groups. I mean, like I said about Hollywood Babylon, I mean, Hollywood was full of that kind of thing anyway, so it may not even need to be Masonic. Could be a kind of hedonistic kind of side to things. But the real thing is the murder in the film, that the girl gets killed and, you know, she disappears. And that's the mystery that he's trying to uncover. And as Sidney Pollack says in the film, you know, the names, I won't tell you names. If I told you the names, you wouldn't sleep so well.
Sure, yeah.
And we don't see who they are, but they're all in masks, like Venetian masks.
Well, this is really what sparked the whole thing, I think. The certain lines from the film that have been seriously influential on the way sort of people perceive the film and what the meaning of the film is. So what about this link with Lyndon LaRouche? Do you know much about that? I mean, all I know is that apparently he subscribed to the magazine that LaRouche puts out. I think it still is available today.
It's probably Executive Intelligence Review.
Yeah.
So I've got a copy of that, yeah.
It's all based on information that we don't necessarily have, you know, we haven't had it firsthand. We don't really know what the original source was. This is all sort of secondary information, but it's interesting nonetheless. But
well, this is pre-internet.
Pre-internet,
so Kubrick was, you know, he used to walk around, because he had a kind of manor house up in Hertfordshire, which is almost like a sort of overlook hotel of himself. And it has been said that The Shining is a portrait of Kubrick. And Jack Nicholson looks quite like him with his beard. He's an American and he's in a big house walking around trying to get the truth. Kubrick used to walk around his house at night because America would be 8 hours behind or whatever. And Los Angeles time, you know, would be way behind. So he'd want to hear the news. He had all the TVs on listening to the American news to keep up with what was going on. But this is before there were lots of cable channels and internet. So he'd have to do it in a slightly different way. But he would have a lot of gadgets. He would have shortwave radio and stuff like that. So he would always be, you know, tuning into things like that.
Mm.
Whether he knew about Alex Jones and things like that, I don't know. He may just have crossed over the start of Alex Jones in about, you know, 97, that kind of time. It's possible. But I think, yeah, there would have been earlier conspiracy types before the stuff we know about. You know, this sort of talk was around. I have seen, you know, hints of it in the past, but not the way we know about it now.
Yeah.
I mean, Arthur C. Clarke, it's been said, Alan Watts spoke a bit about this recently, that Arthur C. Clarke's part of that kind of, you know, movement that wants to see us going off into space. It's very technocratic. And he might, I don't want to knock Arthur C. Clarke because I don't know too much about it, but he could have been part of that kind of like utopian side of science fiction. And whether that was part of 2001, that sense of it must be Darwinian evolution, which is depicted in the film, or, you know, you have intelligences overwhelming us. Is that a higher intelligence, or is that a New World Order type intelligence, you know? Mm. It's hard to know there, because 2001 isn't in one off. The film is very inspiring, but you can read things into it, because it could be what it says, it could be symbolic, you know. And
yeah,
but it has been said, obviously, Clark possibly was the partner there who was more involved with New World Order things, possibly.
Sure, I mean, I think that's the thing. Like, you have to remember with directors, any director, not just Kubrick, unless they are also writing the source material, it's all based on the work of an author, of a writer, of a novelist.
But Kubrick would hunt down books that matched the sort of things he wanted to say.
Yeah, absolutely.
So he was a producer as well. Yeah. He wasn't been told to make that film.
And also he would modify it to an extent to match what he wanted the film to be about. That's or right. The theme of the film, as you said, with various films he's put out. So I can see why there is this... There are multiple theories, but I can see why there is all this debate around Kubrick. Because I just think he was a man that put out so many powerful films that remain as relevant and as great to watch today as they did 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And all of them, like I say, seem to touch on a different theme, whether it's some deep spiritual reality in 2001, you know, the nature of human evolution, etc.
Yeah.
Whether it's New World Order, you know, activity, or arguably New World Order activity in Eyes Wide Shut. And then you've got things like elements of mind control techniques in Clockwork Orange and Clockwork Orange, isn't it? And Full Metal Jacket, absolutely. And then, I mean, obviously you've got things like the Tavistock Institute in the UK, MK Ultra Project, and all this mind control stuff that we know exists now, and perhaps that wasn't really as known about 10, 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
But there's got to be, I mean, there seems to be some kind of correlation there, seems to be some kind of link, but I think particularly with Clockwork Orange, But I've not read the novel. I mean, you've read the Anthony Burgess.
Well, it's very close to the film.
Yeah.
Really, apart from the last chapter, which is may not even be in the issue, the edition you've got, you know.
Mm. So again, it seems like Kubrick somehow has identified some source material that can be used.
Yeah.
But he's been very careful about what he's selected. And there's a sort of theme running with all the things he's put out. And well, this is a theory anyway. And you could go as far as to say that you combine all the films, and in each film has a different message, and all of them represent a combined message that was Kubrick's canon.
Yeah.
Which I don't think you can say that for many directors, because most directors will just make random films, and they can be great films, but they don't seem to be particularly linked or following a sort of strand.
No. I mean, the controversy here is if Kubrick knew about New World Order ahead of when we did.
Yeah.
Was he part of it, putting over the ideas, wanting to promote these ideas, or was he warning against the ideas?
Mm.
You know, if he was an insider, or at least knowledgeable, or had privy to it, maybe going back very many years, you know, was he trying to stop it, or was he trying to promote it? And that's the question, which I think he's trying to warn against it. But I know Alan Watts said he thought he was part of the New World Order, promoting it.
Alan Watts said that on numerous occasions. If I remember right, I think I've heard Alex Jones suggest that as well in the past. But Alex Jones says that about most Hollywood directors. Alex Jones, obviously, most people will know, but Alex Jones is a very well-known conspiracy researcher who puts out a radio show in America, Infowars.com, amongst other things. Obviously, he's a filmmaker as well. But the interesting thing for me as well is obviously going back to one of Kubrick's films, AI, which we know is ultimately you know, directed by Spielberg. Yeah. But again, like with Eyes Wide Shut, that film, when it first came out, didn't go down so well. But all of a sudden now it's gaining popularity, and more people are actually going to that film and watching it now. It's sort of word of mouth, really. And I think that's a very powerful film. It's a very, very rich themes running through that film. Yeah, absolutely. But the question I have is how close is that Spielberg version to what Kubrick envisaged? And I can't help but feel that a Kubrick version of that film would have had a slightly darker edge to it, and perhaps a slightly different ending.
Well, actually, I don't think he was going to direct it, because I think he said to Spielberg, "I don't think I'm the director for this."
Right.
Because I think he... I mean, but Brian Aldiss's ideas would probably be, because he came up with the original story... I think he had an idea. He didn't want all the Pinocchio stuff in. He thought it was getting too much into fairy tales, and he wanted it to be more kind of modern and more kind of esoteric and more science fiction-y about the little boy robot, but making more of a modern kind of idea. And I think Kubrick was trying to weld it with a fairy tale idea. So he moved away from Brian Aldiss's idea a bit. But then Spielberg came in and then did it his own way as well. So what you end up with is a bit of all of them in there. So I think you just got to judge it as its own piece, you know.
Yeah, and it's interesting as well, just briefly touching on Spielberg, because he's another director who, there's been a lot of debate about what Spielberg might know and what he might not know about the nature of reality and about all this business. And although it wasn't, well, in my opinion, it wasn't a particularly great film, the most recent Indiana Jones film, which didn't go down so well, again, you know, critics kind of canned it. I wasn't a fan. I know you weren't a fan either, Peter. But it did have some interesting elements in that film of alien involvement in human affairs, some strange references at the end to alien, you know, intervention in the history of humanity for the last 100 years.
Yeah.
And obviously that whole scene at the end with the saucer coming in.
Yeah.
So, and obviously... Spielberg's work, it does touch on aliens multiple times. Obviously, you've got the really well-known films E.T., Close Encounters, but he also produced a series that allegedly was based on some real-life accounts of alien abduction stories, Taken, which I've not actually seen.
Yeah.
But I guess the deeper question here, and it's Kubrick is absolutely at the forefront of this, but how, you know, it makes you wonder how much these film directors actually do know about all this stuff. Is it just, you know, the obviously the sort of slightly more cynical argument is, well, it's just very good screenplay writers and novelists at the end of the day who tap into all this stuff, and they make good, great stories out of it all. Or there's the view that actually they've got some inside knowledge, and it's all a process of slowly revealing the truth to humanity through through the medium of film and of literature. And I think that's an age old debate, really, and it's certainly one that, you know, you mentioned Alan Watt. I mean, Alan Watt would say it's all controlled by the New World Order.
Yeah.
Everything's controlled by the New World Order. There's not one film director out there who's not utterly compromised by the New World Order.
Yeah.
And it's just sometimes it's difficult to know for sure where these directors come from and what they're all about.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's a very difficult one there, because George Lucas has had a similar criticism, of course, for Star Wars, and whether it's, you know, really, I mean, Alex Jones uses the music in his broadcasts, you know, against the kind of New World Order. But was George Lucas part of something, promoting something? Was he against something, you know?
Yeah.
But without going off into tangents too much, I think Kubrick, you know, obviously came into touch with a lot of things. He was taking a lot of information in. He was certainly, you know, in his own mind, educating himself about the way things were working. Yeah, I'm sure if there's a, well, let's say there is a New World Order, we certainly say there is, so I think we can take that as being a fact, then he would have discovered that at some point. He would have had guests around his house to talk about these things. I'm sure they would let a few things drop now and then. And he's either one of them or he isn't, but there may be people who are whistleblowing on it a bit and giving him bits of information saying, look, you know, you might want to stick this in your film. I mean, one idea I had with Clockwork Orange being withdrawn was that really it was because it had mind control stuff in it, and it was actually showing about trauma-based mind control.
Yeah.
And maybe the government didn't want that. So maybe they were threatening him and saying, look, you know, withdraw this film. But it's nothing to do with the violence, which, although it's bad, there are equally violent films like Straw Dogs, for example, and other films that were more violent, really. It was just perhaps a slightly comical way it was depicted in the film made it nasty. But actually, you know, it could be that the mind control thing was giving away one of their techniques, one of the Tavistock-style techniques that they didn't want known to the public. And so he was putting that into the film and showing it. And maybe they said, look, pull the plugs on this, you know. But they could only control so much, because they couldn't control the world rights to the film.
Mm.
But they could control the rights in the UK by getting him to withdraw it.
No, I mean, just touch on the Clockwork Orange. I mean, there's some interesting symbolism in that film that you don't really glance at first viewing, but when it's revealed to you, it's almost like it kind of touches on subliminal messages, really, and it's stuff particularly prominent in Clockwork Orange, such as in the scene in the courtyard, in the prison courtyard, when all the prisoners are being inspected by one of the chief officers. On the wall in the backgrounds, that you see a painted Illuminati pyramid with an all-seeing eye on the top.
Right.
And it's just a very odd touch, and that shot is quite a sort of infamous shot now, because it obviously Kubrick would have had a final say, and sort of there's no way, I mean, unless you've got some sort of cocky kind of, you know, crew member that's put that on there and it's sort of not been spotted.
Yeah.
Kubrick must have seen that, acknowledged it, or it was probably his idea in the first place.
Yeah, sure.
And it's just an odd bit of symbolism to have in that particular scene. And it's like a slight, perhaps just a slight, it's like I say, subliminal suggestion.
Yeah.
That there is this control system.
Well, maybe he's putting things in the films that you'll pick up on years later.
Well, yeah.
You know, knowing that technology is going to get better, you won't only have a 35mm print.
Yeah.
You might one day have a DVD, or he's got in, you know, in Star Wars 2001, you do see them, they've got things like iPads in that.
Yeah.
So these ideas had already been designed back then, and he was talking to IBM and these companies who were designing all this stuff, but they couldn't make it at the time. You know, but they had all the ideas worked out. I mean, digital photographs were invented back in the 1800s, for example, but they couldn't make them, but they had the idea for them. They were doing, you know, pixels. It's like a knitting pattern, you know.
Sure, yeah.
The video discs are invented in the 1930s. They had video discs that worked. They were gramophone records and very bad quality, but they couldn't play them back even. They couldn't even play back their own video discs. They had to play them back in, I think, the 1990s. They got video off them as well.
Yeah.
So a lot of these ideas are around for a long time before And certainly if Kubrick's talking to those who are designing the technology, like in Star Trek, you've got, you know, the little communicators that are kind of like mobile phones and this sort of thing. And they designed the technology to look like what's in the films now as well. But these ideas were all there in the films. If the films knew this and were putting them out, you know, he'd know that things in the future would be different. Maybe if you put all the stuff in the films and preserve the films well. I mean, Kubrick had black and white masters made of all his films in three colours.
Yeah.
So that the colour would be preserved perfectly. So in the future, perfect copies could be made. And Lucas has done this as well. I mean, it's a kind of pre-digital way of preserving stuff without... Because colour film can fade over a long period and you need to kind of keep it in temperature-controlled conditions. But if you have these black and white intermediate masters, you can actually make a perfect colour film in the future to match the original. And so Kubrick would know this sort of thing. He was doing that ahead of time, ahead of digital stuff. So he may well have thought, well, in the future, they'll be able to watch these films. And if I put stuff in now, you know, it'll be there in the future to refer to.
And so leaving a legacy of this stuff.
Yeah, that's right. That's why he made them such high quality. But looked after all the sort of the negatives and everything. With some directors, you know, they knock stuff out and it doesn't always get looked after so well, you know. I mean, sadly, the negative of Doctor Strangelove was completely lost. No one knows where it is even now. But luckily, it's been backed up in good quality, you know.
Right.
But films do go missing. Well, not nowadays, but they used to in the past.
Yeah, it's fascinating to think that, really. It's just it's just one of those things, I guess, that you people are so used nowadays to hardware, software, and physical, you know, physical systems, hard drives, etc., backing everything up.
Yeah,
it wasn't like that back in the day. But I guess whatever side of the debate you're on, ultimately you have to remember that Kubrick was a legendary film director. And regardless of where the man was coming from, what he knew, what he didn't know, who was influenced by him, people in his life that perhaps we aren't aware of that were, you know, drip feeding him information, etc. Ultimately, he was a great filmmaker, and he his legacy is there for all to see.
Yeah. So.
It's an interesting debate, and I think it's something that is definitely something that we people should consider when they are looking into this line of research. Is, you know, ultimately the deeper question here is one of what's the media's role in all of this, and how close are these people to the truth, and you know what agendas do they have? But at the end of the day, you do have to remember that it's an artistic form. It's an artistic medium, film. And it needs to be kind of seen in context of what it is.
Yeah.
So I hope you've enjoyed this episode. So we'll be back soon with more content. Stay tuned.
The information where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.